From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Sunlight or secrecy, which would you choose? Hello again, I'm Oren Alney, and this is To the Point. The House passed its Obamacare replacement without any public hearings and before the Congressional Budget Office determined what it would do and what it would cost. Now comes the reality check on the pros and cons, a deficit cut of $119 billion, leaving 23 million people without health insurance. At first, many senators said they'd start over from scratch, but now it appears their deliberations will be conducted secretly, too. As debate rages over White House connections with Russia, would most Americans rather know what's next for protecting their health? Later on today's Talking Point, can any White House function the way it's supposed to during an independent investigation? First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. This week we learn more about the health care bill passed in the House without any public hearings. Next week, will the Senate also decide major questions behind closed doors? That's our main topic today. On our Talking Point later, the Trump White House is reportedly not functioning smoothly, but now the president and every staff member is likely to be distracted by the independent counsel investigating ties with Russia. We'll get some lessons from history. First, this news update. At the G7 meeting today in Italy, heads of state are clashing over trade and climate change and terrorism. Yesterday, the newly elected president of France greeted Germany's Angela Merkel before offering his hand to be gripped by President Trump. Was Emmanuel Macron being deliberate? Judy Dempsey is editor-in-chief of Strategic Europe. That's a blog for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. Nice to be back.
Good to have you back. So how is the president impressing the other heads of state in Europe by comparison to the way he was received by heads of state in the Arab world?
He's not impressing them at all. In fact, it's actually incredibly worried. The NATO allies, there's 28 of them, the majority are European, they were on their best behavior. They didn't have any expectations. They just wanted to listen to President Trump, what he was going to say about NATO, about collective defense. And he ended up just lecturing them and essentially haranguing them that they didn't spend enough. And if they weren't going to spend enough, well, they would maybe have to pay the consequences. It was a very, very, unexpected dialogue, for want of a better term, between the leaders and President Trump.
What about the way that he behaved toward them and the way they behaved toward him on a personal basis?
That's a very interesting question. So the NATO so-called summit opened in this beautiful new building, cost a lot of money, over about $1 billion, and they were all welcomed in there, ushered in there, the 28 leaders. And at one stage, Theresa May, who was in shock and very tired and worried about in the aftermath of the Manchester bombings, she was sort of left hanging behind, and all these male leaders didn't do much to include her. And Trump, for some reason, was hanging behind, and he suddenly realized, I should be up in front, at least that was our impression, and he pushed his way through the leaders, pushing the new would-be member from Montenegro, Dusko Markovic, pushing him literally out of the way, pushing past the Hungarians, and made his way up to the front with extraordinary lack of grace and good manners. And it was quite striking. And then he pulled his jacket together and puffed himself up as if he was leader of his version of the world. It was very telling, the chemistry of all of this.
I take it the other leaders did not react well.
Oh, well, the other leaders, Chancellor Angela Merkel, just kept her cool as ever and sort of stayed behind a little. And it was very interesting, the new French president, Emmanuel Macron, whom President Trump did not support at all during the election campaign. He supported Marine Le Pen, head of the National Front, who's anti-EU, Eurosceptic, anti-immigration. Emmanuel Macron, when he was introduced to all the other leaders in this great ceremony, he made a beeline first to President Trump, and then deliberately, clearly, he went over to Angela Merkel, gave her three kisses, then shook hands with other leaders, and then he turned to Donald Trump, and the president gave a big warm handshake. But frankly, everybody knows that President Trump backed the wrong horse when it came to the new president of France.
How about the substance of the meetings, and are they leaning on him, particularly with regard to the Paris Agreement?
The substance was very, very interesting. I think this is probably the first time since the foundation of NATO in 1949 that an American president did not speak about mutual defense, collective defense in Article 5, which means that any ally that is attacked, the allies would come and support it. And this wasn't mentioned at all, either in his official opening speech and during the dinner. Secondly, he just harangued them about not spending enough. And even during the dinner, he actually said, reportedly, this is from my sources, that you Europeans, you need us, meaning the Americans, and more than we need you, and you've got to spend more. And it was very hectoring. And the other issue was security and terrorism. And he was Trump is quite good on this. In the official opening, he asked for a minute's silence after the Manchester bombings. But then he sort of seemed to equate terrorism with immigration, linking the two. And so it left a very ambiguous, if not sour, taste among the allies. In short, the allies really were quite puzzled on how to go forward with the president of the United States.
All right. So that was the situation at the NATO meeting. I take it the G7 meeting today, he might give him a chance to change things, but it seems unlikely.
This is quite important. The G7...
I shouldn't have asked you another question because we don't have enough time left.
So
very
quickly, G7 is made up of democracies. Nobody's behind. There isn't Turkey there or anybody else. And he is going to be gloves off.
All right. Judy Dempsey with the Carnegie Endowment. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Big pleasure.
Always.
Bye.
In a moment, sunlight or secrecy? Which would you choose? On To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, we're only back with To the Point. 3 weeks after House Republicans rushed to replace Obamacare without any public hearings, the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has revealed what the measure would actually do and what it would cost. Next week, the Senate will start writing its own version of the bill, and it appears it will act in secrecy, too. David Leonard of the New York Times has written a column about that, including this line: the effort to take health insurance from middle class and poor and funnel the savings into tax cuts for the rich is a little like mold. It grows best in the dark. David Leonard, welcome to our program.
Thank you. It's nice to be back, Warren.
That's a pretty good line and pretty scathing about the secrecy in which this extraordinarily important bill is being dealt with.
Yeah, I mean, it's really remarkable. Look, the Democrats' process for passing the Affordable Care Act was not perfect, but oh my goodness. I mean, the Senate alone held 44 hearings and other public events over months and months and months. There was a bipartisan working group, even though in the end the bill got no Republican votes. There were just weeks and months of hearings. And in this case, Mitch McConnell, as Politico and others have reported, is basically hoping to keep it all behind closed doors, and he's implored on his caucus not to leak. And there's a basic reason here, which is the bill that the Republicans are talking about passing and that the House did pass is enormously unpopular with the American people. It's opposed by associations representing doctors and nurses and hospitals and retired people and patients of cancer and diabetes and heart disease and multiple sclerosis and you name it. And so this is a case in which public debate is really bad for the bill. And so as an opinion columnist, I would say that I hope that means the bill is going to fail.
On the other hand, it's getting a lot of pressure from President Trump to be passed. He wants to sign it.
Yes, which is remarkable as well, right? Because you don't need a great memory to think back to the campaign where President Trump really said very clearly, look, I want more insurance coverage, not less. I want cheaper insurance coverage, not more expensive coverage. And instead, he's talking about taking health insurance away from, according to the Congressional Budget Office, 23 million people and making it quite expensive. I think what's happened here is a combination of a couple things. I think Republicans spent a long time saying we must repeal Obamacare, and there are real substantive criticisms to make of Obamacare. There are substantive criticisms you can make from the right and try to change the bill from the right. But the basics of the critique of Obamacare was pretty dishonest. It sort of imagined that there are not trade-offs in the healthcare world. And so now that Republicans actually control government, they're in this very tricky situation in which they've made promises they can't deliver on. And so you have a combination of a Congress that pretended health care was easy and is now in the position of having to pass a bill or wanting to pass a bill, and a president who really is not engaged with the details of the policy and wants a win, wants to be able to say, hey, look, we got rid of Obamacare. But there's not a lot of places where they can go substantively that wouldn't do really substantial damage to the American people.
How big a bill is this in terms of the economy as a whole?
It's huge. I mean, healthcare, depending what numbers you look at, is between a fifth and a sixth of the economy. This doesn't touch every aspect of healthcare, but it touches a really big aspect of it. I mean, to put it this way, this would be a net change of 23 million people covered. Then you add probably a whole bunch million more who would have worse coverage. And, you know, you're talking about a bill that would probably affect directly and quite quickly something like 1 in 10 Americans. If your listeners are saying, well, wait a second, still, why are they doing this? I don't get it. Some of it is hard to explain. Some of it is they box themselves in and they want a political win. But there is one substantive reason why they're pursuing this, which is this isn't just a healthcare bill. This is a bill that would really deeply cut taxes for affluent people, and it would cut them most deeply for the most affluent people. And the modern Republican Party has shown that cutting taxes for the well-off, is its biggest single policy priority. And I think that's part of what's driving this bill.
David Leonard, again, a columnist for The New York Times, former Washington bureau chief. Once again, the House passed the bill without the Congressional Budget Office assessment of what it would cost. Speaker Paul Ryan now claims that the CBO's report, which just came out, was good news.
What CBO just told us is the reforms that we put in this bill will help lower premiums. And so I'm very encouraged by that. But I think what members are frustrated with is what's behind the CBO analysis about who gets insured and who doesn't get insured. If you leave it up to a person's choice, then they'll make a choice. If the government's going to stop forcing people to buy something that they don't want to buy, then they won't buy it. And that's basically what CBO is saying.
Karen Pallitz is a senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She was previously working on the Affordable Care Act at the Department of Health and Human Services in the Obama administration. Good to have you on our program.
Thank you.
What do you say to what we just heard from the speaker about lowering premiums?
Well, premiums do go down, according to CBO, under this, but for a couple of reasons. CBO points out that initially premiums go up, and that's when the mandate stops. As the speaker mentioned, some healthy people who would rather not buy insurance or save the money won't, and so that will raise the average cost of the people who stay in coverage, driving premiums up about 20% in the first year. Then the bill makes some new funds available to states for reinsurance programs, essentially that subsidize insurers directly so they don't load all the costs into the premium, and that would start to moderate the price increases. But the bill makes other changes in insurance. It changes the age rating 5 to 1, so that younger people, the spread between younger and older adults' premiums is much greater. It changes the subsidies, cutting them substantially, and also offering older people much less subsidies. So, repeals the requirement that insurers have to offer plans at different deductible levels, a very high deductible bronze all the way up to the low deductible platinum. So over time, CBO says the premiums will start to come down, but that's because a lot of older people will be priced out of the market. So the market on average will be younger, which reduces or brings down the average premium. Policies will cover less because the deductibles will be higher. And so, you know, it cost, I think, kind of pound per pound of insurance won't go down that much, but the average price that people pay for less coverage and less access to coverage will go down.
Let me go back to David Leonard with the New York Times. So we've said that 23 million people will have their health insurance taken away from them. But what about Paul Ryan's case that when you remove the mandate, many people will choose not to have health insurance and be part of that 23 million?
No. I mean, this is a situation in which there may on the margins be some people who say, hey, I'm better off without health insurance, so I'm not going to do it. But really what's going on here is a big transfer of resources. The reason why this bill takes insurance from so many people is it basically takes the money that we're now spending to enable middle class and poor and sick and disabled people to afford health insurance, and it instead turns that money into high-end tax cuts. And so this is not a great victory for freedom. I think the issue here is that my colleague Ross Douthat has written some really smart columns about what a conservative vision for healthcare would really look like. It would look like highly subsidized, pretty bare bones plans like what Singapore has that people could buy into. And so there are conservative visions, serious ones, of what to do here. But that's not in this bill. I mean, this bill really is income redistribution disguised as a health bill. And there's no way to tweak this bill and have it do anything other than hurt a lot of people who right now can't afford to buy health insurance in the individual market.
David Leonard, thanks so much for having been on our program.
Thank you.
Columnist for The New York Times, former Washington Bureau Chief. Tim Carney is now with us, commentary editor at The Washington Examiner, author of Obamanomics, How Barack Obama is Bankrupting You and Enriching His Wall Street Friends, Corporate Lobbyists, and Union Bosses. Tim Carney, good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
Do you agree with what we heard from David Leonard that, in fact, this is a transfer of resources and a way of taking benefits away from poor people, old people, sick people, and giving tax cuts to wealthy people?
It's an interesting admission that during Obamacare debate, the Democrats did not admit that it was a massive tax hike bill. And now that the talk is of repealing the bill, they're admitting that that would be cutting taxes, which is, you know, it's the heart of their party to oppose cutting taxes, but they're admitting that Obamacare was largely about increasing taxes on people, somewhat in a stealthy way. And what this, but certainly the effects when you look at it sort of budget-wise is, yes, the tax hikes that Obamacare put in place will be removed, and some of the subsidies for middle-class people and some of the Medicaid subsidies will be reduced. The purpose of the bill, of course, though, is not to cut anybody's taxes necessarily, but it's to get rid of the regulations that make it basically illegal to sell and buy lower-cost health insurance. And there's a big debate over whether people should be able to buy lower-cost health insurance or whether they should have to buy more comprehensive, but that is at least the intention of the Republicans here, is make it legal again to buy lower-premium health insurance.
David Leonard gave us a list of all the entities involved in healthcare that are against this: the doctors, the nurses, the hospitals, the Cancer Society, the Heart Association, the Diabetes Association, the Lung Association, the March of Dimes, the AARP. Is he right that public debate is bad for the bill? And what do you think about the Senate deciding to do this in secret?
Well, I think that the way that the House handled it, which was relatively secretive, and the way the Senate is doing it so far, I think it's a mistake for a couple of reasons. First, just good government. I think the way to pass and shape a bill is to do it in the open. I wish Obamacare had been a little more in the open, but guess what? It was a lot more open than the Republican process so far.
44 hearings in the Senate alone, according to David Leonard.
Yeah, and the other thing that hearings does is it helps sort of shape the bill in a more consensus-minded way. What House leadership did was it wasn't collaborative, it was consultative. The Republican leaders listened to the concerns of members, and then they wrote the bill behind closed doors. And that's exactly what's happening here, where at a recent Senate meeting I was told that nobody would even stand up and say who was doing the writing of the bill. This was a closed-door meeting of Republican senators. And so happening behind closed doors, there's no way to get either buy-in from members, making it harder to pass. That's why it failed in the House the first time. And I think you end up with a worse result. I believe that the sort of ugly sausage-making process of going through the committees ends up with a better result and a more unified majority in passing it.
Back to Karen Politz. Again, worked on the Affordable Care Act at the Department of Health and Human Services during the Obama administration, now a senior fellow at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Was Obamacare, as it's called, as even the president, former president himself called it, was it in fact a secret tax cut, a tax hike rather, and is that criticism just?
Well, the law did include substantial tax increases to pay for the coverage expansion that was achieved by expanding Medicaid eligibility and then subsidizing private health insurance. So there's no question that the bill was paid for. As enacted, it led to a net reduction in the federal deficit, and you know, undoing it now and coming up with a net reduction again means that the cuts in health spending have to be even deeper.
So, Tim Carney, this bill also does decrease the deficit by $119 billion. Is it doing that on the backs of the people who need health care?
To some extent, it is reducing subsidies for people to buy health insurance. And that number, the 23 million additional without insurance on top of the, it's something like 18 million that currently under Obamacare don't have insurance. So an additional 23, bringing the number up to 41 million. Part of the reason there is that people won't have the subsidies to buy insurance. Another part is that people won't be mandated to do it. And another part is that getting rid of some of the regulations will make it more expensive for other people to do it. And I think part of the response is maybe we need a private insurance industry to be a separate thing from our safety net. And Obamacare was about sort of putting a redistribution and a safety net into the private insurance industry. And for a Republican reform to be good, and I don't think either of I don't think this bill does it. For a Republican reform to really be effective, it has to do both of those things: return the insurance market back to insurance, where people are pooling risk, actual risks that they face but that are uncertain, on the one hand, and then separately strengthen the safety net. That's sort of what Republican campaign trail rhetoric, including President Trump, referred to. And through the processes they've done so far, they haven't gotten to that point in this bill.
All right. Tim Carney, again, with Washington Examiner. I beg your pardon. Conservative. Neither conservatives nor liberals seem to be very happy about this particular bill. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we'll consider this conversation. And later on our program, on our talking point, can any White House function the way it's supposed to, while a special investigation is going on, as is the case now with the Trump administration? This is To the Point from PRI. We're only back with To the Point. So while there is so much public debate and discussion about the Trump White House and the relationship to Russia, America's relationship to Russia and the Trump staff and all of that, the matter of health insurance is being debated first in the House, now in the Senate, and decided pretty much in secret. How does that look to people outside the Washington Beltway? Here's Democratic U.S. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia. He was speaking earlier this month.
When I told Mr. President, I said, Mr. President, 172,000 West Virginians got insurance for the first time. These are working people. They're working on the low end of the socioeconomic, but they got something never had before. They don't know how they got it. They don't know who gave it to them. They don't know the Democrats. Nothing about it. It's Obamacare. They don't know any of that. All they know is they got it. And you know what? They voted for you, Mr. President. As the Democrats gave it to them, they voted for you. They're going to know who took it away from them.
Chris Hernade is a writer and photojournalist who covers poverty and addiction, and he's been touring America for 5 years, interviewing people well outside the Beltway. Chris Hernade, thanks a lot for joining our program.
Thanks for having me.
Our people should look at, our audience should look at some of the pictures you've taken, which are magnificent and very interestingly tell the tale, I think, that we need to hear on this program. What about it? How do people in those parts of the country that are just described by Senator Manchin taking all this debate? They pay any attention to it at all?
Right. I think that quote, you know, that's the quote I would, that perfectly summarizes what I see as well. I mean, I think a lot of people forget, we often forget how little people pay attention to politics. You know, it's our job to pay attention to politics for many, and so we know all the details. But outside of D.C., and the reality for most people is it sounds like two cats fighting in a bag. There's a lot of noise, and no one really knows what's going on. It just seems dysfunctional. But healthcare is visceral, and taking away healthcare from people who might not have had it or might have just gotten it is very visceral, and it's a real thing. And you know, I think of this gentleman I met in Cairo, Illinois, who. A small town at the very, very intersection of the Mississippi and Ohio rivers at the very southern tip of Illinois. He had voted for Trump. He was 54 years old. His name was John. And I saw him, you know, I think about 6 weeks ago. First time in his life he ever voted, he voted for Trump. He voted for Trump for the reason I hear so many people vote for Trump. He thought the system was broken and wasn't working for him, and he just wanted to break it further. He just wanted change. But after Trump got elected, he got brain cancer, and he showed me the scar on his head where he had had surgery, and he said, look, you know, I my life was saved by Illinois' Medicaid, and I'm thankful for that, and I made a mistake, and Trump is making a mistake. And, you know, that's just one story, but that story is you're going to, you know, over the course, if this bill goes through, that story is going to be told multiple times, you know. And more people are going to wake up to the fact, a realization that they know who took it away.
As Senator Manchin said, and will they also conclude that it was the Democrats who had given it to them, and will they decide or believe that the Democrats will give it back?
I mean, just from political calculations, that's not necessarily important. it will Trump will lose if people think he took it away, because remember, this is a gentleman who never voted before. He's one of those people who just that is not uncommon. I met a lot of people, a lot of Trump voters, that is, who were people who had either voted for Obama twice and then voted for Trump, or had never voted before, hadn't joined the political process until Trump came, and they were so outraged by the direction of the country in their mind. That they join the political process. You're gonna, you know, this will hurt Trump politically in two ways. It will change a few people, but more and more, I think it will dampen enthusiasm. Those people who went out finally and voted won't come out again.
On the other hand, might that, though, save the day for Trump in a sense, because there are people on the other side that are discouraged as well by his administration.
Right. I mean, I think, you know, I think there is. You know, I think the general, again, the general sense, at least what I hear, is people don't pay a lot of attention. Not to details. I personally think it's a lot to ask them to do that. I mean, like, people's lives are busy, and you know, they have a lot on their plate. But again, healthcare is one of those issues that I think beyond the moral issue, I think politically is a mistake for the Republicans.
What about the guy who pointed to the jungle gym when you asked him a question? Tell us about that.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the sad realities of, you know, of poverty for a lot of people is just not having health care. That's just a fact. You know, I was in Lumberton, North Carolina, and I was in a housing project, and I was talking to a gentleman. He worked 40-hour weeks at a fast food franchise, and you know, he was frustrated, and I asked him about not having health care, and he said, I got health care. You know, he points to the jungle gym. I do my pull-ups. I run three miles a day. I stay in shape. You know, that's what people have to do in their mind. It's just a fact. It's a reality for them. And this was in a state that hadn't adopted the expansion of Medicaid. So I think, you know, there's a lot of people that it's just a fact of life.
Chris Hernotti, once again, writer and photojournalist. Tim Carney, back to you with the Washington Examiner. Obamanomics, your book, how Barack Obama's bankrupting you and enriching his Wall Street friends, corporate lobbyists and union bosses. What are the risks right now for Donald Trump and for the Republicans, given what we've just heard from Chris Hernotti and what we heard earlier from Senator Manchin?
I think you have to look at exactly what happened 8 years ago when Democrats took over, had control of Congress, took over the White House, and passed a bill reshaping the healthcare system. Mostly because they did that, they lost the House, made huge losses in the Senate, and dampened the political capital that President Obama had. And I think we are going to look at sort of the mirror image of that. I think a lot of people, they're not political, as Chris was saying, and there's a type of conservatism they have, which is they don't want somebody coming in from the outside and messing with their stuff. And what Obamacare did is it came and it messed with their stuff. And Obama said, no, if you like it, you can keep it. If you like it, you can keep it. People didn't really believe him. He wasn't really telling the truth. And they didn't like government coming in messing with their stuff. And they voted out the Democrats. But now their stuff includes Obamacare. And so Republicans are coming in and messing with their stuff. So I see a replay, mirror image of 8 years ago is a clear and present risk for Republicans.
So when John in Cairo, Illinois, discovered Medicaid when he had brain cancer, all of a sudden he had some stuff that he didn't want to see messed with.
That's exactly right.
Well, then why would we mess it? Why would we get rid of it?
So the Medicaid is not, you know, the expenses of that are going way up and different states handling it different ways. The Republican idea is to block grant it so that each state can come up with a way to be more efficient so that the Medicaid is going towards the people like that man with brain cancer who need it and is not being wasted, is not going to people who could theoretically buy their health insurance on their own or going to hospitals or you know, procedures that are unnecessary. That if states are sort of getting, here's your lump sum of Medicaid, figure out the best way to treat the disadvantaged and the poor with that. And then everybody else, we're going to try to get onto private markets. That's the idea of block granting it. And just at some point, there's trade-offs and the cost of it. We want the money in Medicaid to be going to the people who need it most. How to make that reform happen is tricky. That's one reason why Republicans think more federalism, giving states block grants based on their poor population, that's the best way to let reform come about.
Karen Politz, we're back to you with the Kaiser Family Foundation, formerly with the Obama Department Health and Human Department of Health and Human Services, where you worked on the Affordable Care Act. The Republicans are saying, Paul Ryan has said it many times, that in fact Obamacare is in fact falling apart and it doesn't just need to be fixed, but replaced. Does it need to be fixed?
It definitely needs showing up in some areas. There's no question. Even before the election, There were areas in the country where we were seeing insurers pulling out of markets. Common features in those areas were that they were rural counties with sparse populations. It's hard for multiple insurers to compete to cover just a small number of people. They were non-expansion states, so the individual market had to pick up a lot more of the poorest individuals who tend to be more expensive. Some of those states were governed by, you know, opponents of the ACA, so they were not helping the marketplaces to work, sometimes actively undermining them.
So if the states get block grants, does that worry you then?
Yeah, so the Medicaid changes are absolutely the fiscal footprint and the coverage footprint of the House bill, quite apart from what happens in the marketplace. Of the $1.1 trillion in direct federal spending for health care that is cut in this bill, over $800 billion of that comes out of the Medicaid program. And the majority of people who lose coverage, if this bill were to be enacted, would come out of the Medicaid program. The bill not only rolls back federal funding for the eligibility expansion for poor adults, but the per capita cap limits how much the federal government will spend going into the future on Medicaid.
Okay.
In the past, you know, it grew when there was a growth in need, including public health emergencies like opioid outbreaks in Ohio and Hurricane Katrina in Louisiana. The federal government, you know, helped to pay for that growth.
Let me specifically go back to Chris Arnotti. In the context of the opioid epidemic and the kind of addiction that we're seeing in places around the country where we have never seen it before, Chris, tell us about that, and let's get back away from the numbers and into the experience that people are having with healthcare.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I just wrote a piece on Portsmouth, Ohio, where you know, I've spent 5 years looking at addiction, primarily in minority communities, primarily in South Bronx, inner cities, and Portsmouth was the problems there were on par with the problems you've seen and long seen in minority communities with drugs and addiction, you know, 20, 30 years ago as well. They're overwhelming the towns. They're not just overwhelming the towns financially. They're overwhelming the towns structurally. The towns just are not able. You know, the spirit of the town is broken, and you're having a level of dysfunction and a level of things taking place. Kids taken away from their mothers, families. You know, overdoses that are just taxing both the infrastructure of the communities, but also their spirit.
And these are white middle class or formerly middle class
right. Communities. Yeah, you know, Portsmouth used to make things. It used to make steel boots and other things, and it quite honestly doesn't make that much anymore, unfortunately. And it's a town whose population has been cut in half over. I don't want to pick on Portsmouth because it's a beautiful town and the people there are wonderful individuals, but it's dealing with a situation that, you know, they themselves can't deal with. You know, Scioto County had, you know, 5 years ago, roughly 80 children in state custody who had been taken away from parents. It now has 230 or so. You know, the amount of every siren you hear, and you hear them constantly, is rushing to provide Narcan to someone overdosing. You know, the first night I got there, someone was effectively overdosed in the McDonald's parking lot where I was. So it's really breaking the spirit of the town. And I you know, I think the financial, you know, I think there has been an impressive financial response. I don't think that has been the primary problem. The primary problem is that these towns just can't deal with the complications that are coming, the complex complications.
So this goes well beyond the health care bill, it would seem to me. You can't expect the health care bill to solve all of those problems, can you? Doesn't it also have to do with a changing economy?
Certainly, and I think, you know, I think that, again, you know, listening to the conversation, and no disrespect to the conversation, is it's all very numbing to people. It's just complex details, and it just, again, when you're in these communities and you're sitting in a parking lot and someone overdoses right next to you, you know, what, who funds what, who gets expanded on what. They just seem like really small issues compared to the on-the-ground reality that people are, you know. And there, and I have to say, and this is unfortunate that I have to say this, there's a cynicism building into the communities, a frustration. You know, there's been this wonderful response, general response of understanding addiction and being more empathetic towards the issue, but I think we're getting to a stage of pushback where I think there is this, you know, this question of why are we spending so much resources on these people? And that's certainly not my view, but it's a view that I hear voiced more and more.
Does that come from Republicans, from Democrats, or from both?
It's nonpartisan. It comes from people in the community who, you know, are feeling very much like they've lost control of their town.
So what do you see in the future then? We have elections coming up, and obviously the situation is being much debated in Washington. We've heard a lot of the debate, and as you've indicated, it's somewhat abstract to the people that are probably most involved and most affected by it. What do you predict?
Well, my core view has always been that for a lot of people, voting for Trump was represented an immense frustration with the status quo. Things weren't working, so they're just going to take a long shot. It didn't matter what that long shot was. They're going to take a long shot. That's certainly true in the black and the white communities, given Trump's policies. If he fails to deliver, and by delivery I mean making their life meaningfully better by diminishing the number of overdoses, by bringing jobs back, by stopping people, you know, by providing people like John with Medicaid when he has brain cancers, or their congregant who is like John who develops that, and he's going to be tossed out as well. You know, there's only so much people will put it. They, in my mind, a lot of people simply said, this isn't working for me. Let's knock over the checkerboard. Let's try something else. And if that something else isn't working for them either, then they're going to do the same thing.
Chris Hernati, once again, a writer and photojournalist covering poverty, addiction, and touring America outside the Beltway for 5 years, interviewing people about the issues we're talking to. Thank you so much for being on our program. Thanks to Tim Carney, commentary editor at the Washington Examiner, author of Obamanomics, Karen Politz at the Kaiser Family Foundation, formerly with the Obama Department, the Obama Administration's Department of Health and Human Services, and our earlier guest, David Leonard, with the New York Times. Great to have you all with us. Back in a moment with To the Point, we'll talk about how the White House can function or not when it is dealing with a special investigation. This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Ana here with today's talking point. The latest person of interest in the probe of the Trump White House is presidential son-in-law Jared Kushner, who's been assigned massive responsibilities. The work of independent counsel Robert Mueller is bound to be an enormous distraction, even though Kushner has not been accused of anything, or he's only a person of interest. That's according to Russell Riley, the co-chair of the Presidential Oral History Program at the University of Virginia. His books include Inside the Clinton White House and Oral History. Good to have you with us, Russell Riley.
Glad to be with you. Thank you for having me on.
Tell us what we have learned, or what you have learned from the Clinton White House about what, and other White Houses as well, about what an independent investigation, such as the one being conducted by Robert Mueller, is going to do to the attempt to conduct business.
Well, I think it means that this White House has gone from miserable to perilous in terms of working there. Any White House is a difficult place to work because of an extreme amount of pressure on you, given the kinds of responsibilities that you have for governing the nation. On top of that, if you have a major investigation, as was true persistently during the course of the Clinton White House, it has a terribly disruptive force on, or exercises a terribly disruptive force on the workplace, and makes a very hard job almost impossible to do.
Tell us more about the Clinton White House and what various people said about their experience there and what sorts of choices it forced them to make.
Well, I think one of the first things that it does is it requires people to lawyer up. I mean, if you, the Kushner case that you just mentioned is a very good example of the problem, because Kushner does have his hand in so many different things in this White House: Mexico policy, the Middle East, Iraq, opioid addiction, veteran affairs, on and on and on. The president keeps adding responsibilities for him. And so anybody that has any engagement with Kushner on these issues has to be worried that they, too, could be drawn into the orbit of an investigation, and particularly if they were working with him on the campaign or if they are in the core of any of the main subjects that would be under the orbit of the investigation, like Russia relations, then the wise thing to do would be to get a lawyer. And you also have to build protective moats around yourself. You have to be very careful about not communicating to people who otherwise would be under investigation. Otherwise, they're going to have to get lawyered up. And it simply takes an environment where you have to have a good working relationship and good esprit de corps under the best of circumstances. And it it makes that almost impossible because of these the sense of self-preservation that staff members have to have in that environment. Every one of them, if they hire a lawyer, the lawyer will tell them, you have to look after yourself first and foremost. That's not good for the president, and it's not good for the conduct of public business.
Let's go back to the Clinton administration. Started out with an investigation of what was referred to as Whitewater, which had to do with alleged abuses by the Clintons. Ended up with Monica Lewinsky. You describe one guy who came to the Clinton White House thinking, wow, this is great. This is my first job in this very powerful situation. He walked into a room. They told him to walk out.
That's exactly right, because they were this was the day after the news of Monica Lewinsky broke, and they were discussing the White House response to that. And Larry Stein, who was a congressional relations head, walked in, and the political advisor, Doug Sosnick, pointed a finger out the door and said, get out now unless you want to hire a lawyer. So, again, it's evidence of the point that I just made a moment ago, which is that although you'd love to be focused on the public's business, you have to start looking after yourself under these circumstances.
So he might have heard something about the strategy that would
exactly
then make
right.
him a person of interest to the investigators.
That's exactly right. The investigation that's going on will be focused not just on the business of potential Russian influence over the election, but also on how the White House itself has been managing this, if there are signs that the that people have lied about their experiences. And so one of the great lessons from the Clinton presidency is that although there may be a relatively narrow scope defined for an independent investigator to begin with, it can morph into something dramatically different, and accordingly, anybody working in any tangential way with Jared Kushner has to be worried about these things. A perfect example is the head of the Council of Economic Advisers yesterday said that he was interested in pursuing the lessening of tensions with Russia and trying to remove some of the sanctions that had been issued against Russia. Well, that's right in the wheelhouse of the Mueller investigation. If there's any signs that he's had communication with Kushner about this, then that person is likely to be swept up in this investigation as well. So it is a very dangerous web of peril that's being woven that virtually anybody in this White House could get caught up in unless they're very careful. One of the additional things that we learned in a vast course of interviews with Clinton people is don't put anything in writing, that the documentary record can get you in great trouble. And as you might imagine, in your everyday work experience, it's very difficult for people under normal circumstances just to rely on their memory and the conduct of business. If you're in a situation where you don't feel comfortable making notes or passing memoranda along, any of which could be subpoenaed, then it complicates your life immensely.
What about the difference between the two situations we've talked about, the Clinton administration, where Kenneth Starr was appointed by a judge, and the situation now with Robert Mueller, appointed by the deputy attorney general, subject to being fired by him or by the president?
That is correct. I actually think that's probably a distinction without a difference. I hope so. It does mean that Mueller is subject to being let go by the Justice Department through the president, in which case you could end up with something that, that does very closely look like Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre, where he insisted that the Justice Department get rid of the independent investigator Archibald Cox under those circumstances. I think given the firestorm that surrounded the James Comey firing earlier, that the president's political antenna are probably very much attuned to this right now. I can't imagine circumstances in which they would fire Robert Mueller, given what had happened before. My suspicion, and you know, I don't have a very good track record at predictions on things, but what I would be paying attention to is ultimately how the president elects to use his pardoning power. I mean, he could let this investigation go on for as long as he wants to. The investigator could indict some people, could even convict, and at that point, the president has the untrammeled authority to pardon anybody he wants to. It's one of the few unilateral presidential powers in the Constitution. He would obviously take political heat for doing that, but he has shown very little concern about anything other than maintaining his political base, which would probably applaud that kind of activity.
All right, you're getting kind of ahead of the game here. In the meantime, I take it your advice to people in the Trump White House is keep your head down.
What happened in the Clinton White House was actually very interesting, and that is that much as Lawrence Stein was encouraged to do, they compartmentalized. And so there were people who were responsible for policy issues or for political issues, and they were segregated
okay.
from the investigation. That's the best way to deal with it,
right.
is to try to separate the political from the legal.
Stay out of the room. Russell Riley, professor at the University of Virginia, co-chair of the Presidential Oral History Project. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
To the Point, produced this week by Katie Cooper, Sasha Woodruff, Yael Evan Orr, and Luke Vanderplug. Thanks also to Devin Schwartz. Our technical director is Mike Newport, managing producer Evan George. Thanks also to the John Coltrane family. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
Public Radio International.